You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. New York Times best-selling author J.D. Barker joins me on this episode as we discuss his career so far and his latest book, the supernatural thriller, Something I Keep Upstairs. A new twist on the classic haunted house book, J.D. also discusses some of the strangeness located on this real-life location and explains how you can get the chance to win an overnight stay in the haunted house that inspired it. But before that, of course, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. And you can always click the link in the show notes. And thank you to each and every one of you that support the show with your contributions. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for news and episodes, and please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also visit our exclusive merchandise store, which is available with TeePublic, and the link for that is in the show notes too. Our intro and outro music are performed by the marvellous Weary Pines. Thank you as always to Dean Bestall for his wonderful artwork, and the show is produced by Mr. Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys. What would you do if you inherited a house on its own island? In Something I Keep Upstairs, you may change your mind on how you answer that question. Just over 10 years ago, author J.D. Barker kicked the doors in with his debut novel, Forsaken, flying off the shelves and began a rise to become an internationally renowned best-selling novelist. In the years since, J.D. has created a devoted fan base for both the thriller and horror genres, and his latest book, Something I Keep Upstairs, features a teenager who inherits a house on its own island and the inevitable twist to an opportunity too good to be true. J.D., I'm delighted to welcome you to Mysteries and Monsters, sir.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm going to have you follow me around and just read that intro anytime I walk into a room. That was perfect.
Thank you very much. I like to not overblow my guests, but give them the welcome I think many of them deserve. And you're certainly in that pantheon of people who deserve such accolades that I mentioned there.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate it. It's crazy to think it's only been 10 years, but like it's been a lot of stuff over 10 years.
Absolutely. I mean, you've had a very intriguing and interesting career so far. Obviously, as a child, you had a love of reading, and despite your family's sort of white-collar background, as most of us had, your parents were clearly very invested in assisting and nurturing both yourself and your sister's love of reading, which you got as children. I know I've heard you on previous interviews where you were creating your own library and even having the audacity to charge your sister late fees if she didn't return your self-penned books.
Well, she should have brought them back on time. It's all her fault. I mean, we grew up without a TV in the house, which, you know, this was the 70s, you know, so that doesn't really mean a whole lot. We had three channels back then, so there was nothing worth watching anyway. Yeah. But our mom took us to the library, you know, pretty much. I mean, like my earliest memories are going to the library. I think I was reading by the time I was three. So, you know, that was just one of those things, you know, like we played library at home.
Well, there are far worse hobbies that children could have, and certainly one that seems to have sort of built itself into your DNA going forwards. Because obviously, you've built an incredibly successful career in business and marketing. You sort of saw a lot of pop stars as well in your early life, where you were working alongside them, and sort of saw how fast their comets would trail as they went through their careers and bad investments, often many of them, and someone myself similarly, having worked in the music industry sort of to the side of it, but got to see a few people. It's remarkable how quickly some people can be here today and gone tomorrow, as it were, JD, especially in the music business. Is that something that's kind of set you up going forwards? Because whilst I mentioned in the introduction, it's been a career that's probably exploded in the last decade for you as an author, it was a very slow sort of germination to that point. You were writing all the way up until you decided to sort of bite the bullet and go into this full time?
Yeah, I mean, what you're hinting at there is way back in the 90s when I was in college, one of my first jobs, I worked for BMG Distribution, which is a division of RCA Records. I was in South Florida, so anytime they had a recording artist come into the area, I'd have to pick them up at the airport, get them to the radio stations for their interview, get them to their concert, their hotel, and then get them back on an airplane. Yeah, so I saw a lot of people that, you know, like they would have that one hit, you know, and all of a sudden all this money would start coming in. They didn't know what to do with it, so they just spent, you know, kind of expected it to just continue. And I would see them get these big houses on South Beach in Miami, and, you know, they'd get a nice car, and, you know, they'd take their friends out to dinner every night. And by friends, you know, 15, 20 people, like these weren't small little entourages. But then over time, you know, like their second or third song would come out. It didn't do quite as well. I saw them downsize the house to an apartment. You know, the Lamborghini went away, and all of a sudden they're driving a Toyota Corolla. And everything just kind of disappeared. And like all this played out, you know, with some of them over 3 months, 6 months. I mean, it was a very short time frame. And that scared me, I think, a lot back then. I had no real training in finance or anything, but like that was a real crash course. So when my book started selling, my second one, Forsaken, did really well out of the gate. I sold about 250,000 copies. And that was enough to put me on the radar of the traditional publishers. So when my second book was ready, The Fourth Monkey, we ended up in a bidding war for that. And I got really lucky. I got a 7-figure deal with a TV show and a movie attached. And my wife, you know, we talked about, you know, like, what are we going to do with this money? And yeah, you know, last thing I wanted to do was just put it in the checking account and, you know, do exactly what I saw all these people do. So we took it and we bought real estate. We bought a bunch of rental properties, and, you know, we lived off the income from those properties. So rather than living off the money coming in from the books, we lived off the passive income we were generating from the profits from the books. And we still do that to this day. We've got a ton of real estate that we own, you know, stock market investments and things like that now. We don't live off the writing income that comes in and it gets allocated to other things, which is something they should teach everybody, I think, in school. You know, like they teach us the exact opposite. You know, like, I don't want to turn this into a finance podcast, but, you know, here in the States, you know, they encourage you to take out loans to go to school. You know, all the credit card companies are lined up right there, you know, at college, and they're handing out credit cards left and right before kids really even understand what that means. You know, you're running up all this debt, and before you know it, you've got a house with a big mortgage payment on it. You've got a car that's on loan, and you're stuck. And that's kind of where I was to a certain extent. I finished up college. I ended up working in finance. Ultimately, I was a chief compliance officer at a brokerage firm. And I had all the trappings of that life. My salary was ridiculous. It was huge. But, you know, we had a big house. We had cars. We had a boat. Like, we basically, you know, we spent all that money, you know, at the time. We saved very little of it. It went back into supporting that lifestyle. So when we decided to actually try and make the writing thing work, I couldn't just walk away from the career. We were trapped because we had we had to make that mortgage payment. So my wife came up with this crazy plan. We sold everything that we owned. We bought this tiny little duplex in Pittsburgh, rented out one side to some tenants, and we moved into the other side and got our monthly expenses down to next to nothing, to the point where I could quit the day job and focus 100% on writing.
Do you think that was important? Because I think for some people, JD, they would look at the fact that you were earning a very comfortable salary, and you were someone that was writing as well, and you tried to write even a couple of hundred words every day still, because it's one of those things, you've got to keep your brain sharp. I think a lot of people forget that you should really utilize your brain on a daily basis, because it can go stale. And often people, especially when we speak with authors and things, I think some people are quite surprised that even when people have been very successful, that they still have these kind of regimes and these little tricks that just keep them ticking along, as it were, even if you're going on holiday or something. And like I say, you don't have to try and sort of thrash a chapter out or something, but as long as you're trying to do something, you're still keeping that brain moving. You've got the cogs and the gears worked up and oiled.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it feels very much like writing is, it's almost like working out. It's like going to the gym and exercising. There's a writer muscle. And I think if you do it every single day, it gets stronger and you get better at it, and you're able to write more, you're able to lift more. Like, it's all the same thing. If you take a step back, you take a week or two off, you know, all of a sudden it's, you know, you can't lift as much, you can't write as much. It's, you know, it becomes more difficult. You know, when it comes to writing in general, I think, you know, I was working 60 to 80 hours a week in the corporate gig, but I would come home and I would write, you know, at night. I would write in line at the, you know, when I was getting lunch at the gas station, whenever I got a chance, and I would try to knock out at least 200 to 300 words a day. And my general thinking was, you know, if I could do that, that's a novel within a year. I was working as a book doctor and a ghostwriter while I was in the finance world. You know, so writing was just, it was always my hobby. It was my go-to fun thing to do. You know, so I did it whenever I could.
I mean, obviously, as I also mentioned in the introduction, you've kind of crafted a very devoted niche in regards to these markets. But I think the thing that I'm very impressed with is that you've got this ability to write incredibly tense, taut thrillers featuring some very hard-boiled detectives and some rather unpalatable serial killers terrorizing certain neighborhoods. But then you've also got a lot of supernatural thrillers going on as well. And I think often it's very easy for an author such as yourself. You had such a great success with that first book, Forsaken, which is a wonderful story about witchcraft and sort of returning to the modern era, as if whilst everybody else is kind of carrying on and happy in the modern era. Was it a conscious decision? Because it's very easy for an author to sort of hit the ground running in such a way and then be stuck in that particular genre going forward. So even though they may feel they've got other stories, and sometimes you have to get to a certain point in your career for some people, JD, that they get big enough to be able to try their hand at anything. Whereas you've kind of kept your fan base on their toes by sort of jumping over these borders.
Yeah, I mean, working, you know, I did the book doctor ghostwriter thing for 20 some years. So I worked on a lot of projects, worked with a lot of agents, a lot of editors. And I saw exactly what you were talking about. I saw, you know, people, they would have this one book that would just completely take off. And before you know it, they had to write that same book, but different over and over and over again. I like to pick on Lee Child just because it's fun. But like his real name is Jim Grant. You know, so if you go to his Wikipedia page, it's, you know, it's no secret. But he was writing under a number of different pseudonyms, and the Jack Reacher books ended up taking off. So all of a sudden he became Lee Child, and that's who he had to be. And he was selling so many of those books, he couldn't write anything else. And you know, he did that year after year after year. And you know, like, I just honestly felt like he was getting burnt out on it. And you know, he retired a couple of years ago and handed the whole thing off to his brother. And now he's sneaking out short stories. Like if you go on Amazon, he's got brand new short stories he's putting out there without any real fanfare. He's writing what he wants to write. I didn't want that to happen to me. That scared me half to death. I know a lot of people in this industry, and I had a conversation with Dean Koontz about it. And he told me that, well, if you want to move around, you know, figure out what your common thread is. So in my case, it's suspense. So every one of my novels is a suspense novel, and it may include elements of horror. It may include elements of sci-fi or romance or this or that, but that common thread is always there. And because of that, the readers come along for the ride. And I purposely bounce around in genres, which my agent hated at the beginning. The publishers hated it at the beginning because they want to put you in a box. They want to be able to say, you are a horror author, you are a this, you are a that, which just makes it easier for them to sell you. But I look at it a little bit differently. I look at it as being a literary Pied Piper. So I will write a horror novel, and that brings in a certain, you know, audience. And then I'll write a thriller, which brings in a different audience. But if I have a common thread between the two, you know, the horror readers will come along, the thriller readers will come along. So all of a sudden, I've increased my audience size. So at one point, I was told that my audience was women 45 and over. So I wrote a young adult book and wrote in a whole bunch of younger people into that crowd. So I use genre as a way to basically increase my overall audience.
Well, I think it's fascinating because you have to look at probably the best example of this is Stephen King, I would suspect, JD, because he's been able to build on sort of that sort of first decade of his incredible horror work that he built to suddenly just dive off into different things. I mean, the Bachman books is a prime example of, you know, he didn't think people would read books that weren't in that sort of field that he'd built up. And then for now, people have obviously, we went back sort of in the 90s and people adored them when they realized, I think a lot of people realized who it was at the time, because there are obviously certain tics that certain authors have and the like. But he was trying very different things. He was working with that. And you can see that in some of his short story collections as well, that he wasn't just sort of entrenched in horror. He was trying to branch out. And I think for me, the first book of his I read that, whilst technically it is a horror story, but it involves real people, for me was Dolores Claiborne, because that was such a diversion from everything of his I'd read previously that for the first couple of chapters, I wasn't really with it. And then it suddenly clicked. And then I realised that horror is everywhere, really. Just because we haven't got a big scary monster there doesn't mean that the tale that the author is telling is any less scary.
Yeah, I mean, I've studied Stephen King very closely. I look at all the big name authors and try to figure out exactly how they got there. And King is a fantastic example of that. And if you really look at his books closely, he really just hit all the horror tropes. You know, Carrie was about telekinesis. Then he wrote Salem's Lot, which is a vampire book. He wrote The Shining, which is a haunted house story. Dead Zone, which is, you know, somebody who can see the future. Like, he was just taking these tropes that have been done to death over and over again and hitting each of those marks. But at the same time, he fell into that trap that you had mentioned earlier. Like, if he had turned in, you know, like one of the Richard Bachman books as a Stephen King book, his publisher would have probably pushed back on him and said, no, you need to give us some horror because that's what people are buying from you. You know, so he wrote these Bachman books. And then at one point, you know, the fact that Richard Bachman was Stephen King, you know, came out. And I don't think that was an accident. I'm pretty sure his camp said, okay, we're going to let people know who this is. And now all of a sudden his readers reached out. They started reading these books that were very different from him. And now all of a sudden they're on board for both. And that allowed for a book like Dolores Claiborne to be written and accepted by his reader base. Like, I don't think Dolores Claiborne could have happened without Richard Bachman books, you know, being there first. And, you know, in today's world, he's writing, you know, thrillers, you know, with Holly and, you know, some of these other books that he's got, there's very little supernatural involved, very little horror. You know, he's chasing that, you know, straight up thriller model. But his fans come along for the ride. And I think that's what's important. You know, like, as an author, you need to look at your brand. You have to build a brand. And the publishers don't necessarily, you know, want to do that. They want to sell that one particular book that they bought. They don't really care what you're going to do, you know, a year or two down the road or, you know, how it's going to work out. Their focus is on that one title. So you have to look at it as a business.
Absolutely. And I think it's one of those things, it's like when you've got a favorite band, JD, and they decide to go in a different direction after about three or four albums. And sometimes the fans just don't want that. But then they pick up people who think, oh, well, I've always thought they'd be really good if they tried this. And so when you come to writing that, I suppose for you, has it always been sort of difficult to fix that particular story in which genre you're wishing to keep it in? Or for you, is it freer that you've got this ability to craft a bit of supernatural suspense into what for some people would be a thriller story until something strange goes on?
Yeah, I mean, I find that if I keep the common thread of suspense alive through the whole book, when it comes to writing paranormal or supernatural, I have to make it believable. You know, so if there's going to be a ghost in the story, I have to have a very believable reason for that ghost to be there. It has to be something that could happen in real life, or at least feel like it could happen in real life. And I think that's the key to it. If you're writing straight up horror, you can get away with a ghost story. You can write a zombie apocalypse novel. You can do whatever you want. And people understand that that's what they're buying. That's what they're looking for. But when you do a thriller, like, people expect everything in that book to be something that could happen today, you know, or tomorrow in your near future. So, you know, like, I try to incorporate those other elements, whether it's sci-fi or horror, in a way where it does feel real. And I think that honestly, it works better, you know, because as a reader, like, that's what I enjoy. You know, like, if I stumble into a ghost in a story that shouldn't necessarily have a ghost, but it makes perfect sense for it to be there and how it got there, you know, I'm along for that ride.
Absolutely. I think sometimes one of my favorite books growing up was Haunted by James Herbert, which is a very strange story, especially when you're 13 and you're not that, you're perhaps a little bit ahead of the game reading books of that nature at that age, JD. But it was one of the first books I read where halfway through I realized that I wasn't reading a person's story. I was actually reading a ghost's story. And it just blew me away at 13. I was thinking, this is just incredibly clever that someone would try that. And he's another one, Herbert, where he kind of flipped from doing sort of horror, to then sort of by the mid-80s, he'd started crafting these weird supernatural thrillers where sometimes halfway through, especially after I'd read Haunted, I was always sort of checking myself to think, am I really understanding what's going on here? Or is one of those books where I have to get to the very end to then think everything I thought until the sort of the last chapter was nonsense and the author has completely tricked me all the way through?
Yeah. And, you know, like, if it's done right, that works. You know, The Shining is another great example of that. You know, like, it comes across as a haunted house story. But in the end, all of this really could be in the head of the main character, you know, and we, as a reader, we don't really know, but it's believable. And that's what's key. Hmm.
I think one of the things that's always struck me about yourself is over the last decade or so, you've kind of really pushed the envelope in regards to changing the way books are marketed. I'm aware that when you released the second book in the 4MK series, that a letter from the serial killer was sent out to bookshops, which is brilliant. I mean, obviously, you turn the letter over and there's the marketing bump on the back. But, you know, you weren't sort of trying to terrify as many booksellers as you possibly could. Though I do believe that one did actually think it was a real letter and ended up getting the authorities involved. But is it a conscious decision to try and be different? Because obviously there's lots of things that people tend to do. The sort of cliches in regards to marketing a book, they look at your Instagram following. They look at how you sort of do videos on TikTok. I mean, do you dance around your kitchen sort of promoting a book? And they look at that kind of thing, whereas you've kind of gone, it seems to me anyway, JD, that you look at what people do and think, well, rip that up. I'm going to do this box of different things.
Yeah, I look very closely at what everybody else is doing to promote their titles. And then once I've got a handle on what people are doing today to market their books, I try to come up with something that nobody is doing. You know, to give you an example. So like when TikTok came out, you know, nobody wants to see me dancing around holding my book, you know, like, but every author tries that, right? They try to come up with some funny video or whatever. They hope to go viral. They film it. You know, they've got their X number of followers and they just hope that it's like that. That to me is a losing sum game. You can't do that. So what I ended up doing is I created a company. I hired some college kids to get email addresses for BookTok influencers, people who report on books on TikTok. We put together a list of around 3,000 of them. You know, the smallest one's got 8,000, you know, followers. The largest one has a couple million. And we created a weekly email that goes out to them. I struck deals with all the major publishers where I get ARC copies, and I put them in the hands of those influencers. So once a week, the influencers get an email with, you know, here are the five or six titles that are available. Which ones would you like? And they get free copies of these ARC books. And, you know, we do that, you know, religiously every Tuesday it goes out. What it allows me to do is I can drop my own title in there whenever I want. So now all of a sudden I can put my own book in front of this giant group of influencers and I can offer those ARC copies up and they create those videos and they know their audience. They know, you know, exactly what sells. Like it is not as simple as just creating a video. I mean, there's so much involved in something like that. Like I don't want to learn another industry, and that's essentially what you would have to do. Yeah. So I rely on the people that know how to do it.
Well, I think that's the cornerstone, I think, of knowing your product as well, JD, that you understand what your weaknesses are, and therefore you're also able to utilize others' strength in regards to that. You know, you're a damn fine author with a sharp marketing brain. But as you just said, nobody really wants to see JD Barker dancing around his kitchen. I mean, some people might, but probably a lot of people wouldn't. However, you know that, and therefore that gives you probably a more honest sort of ability to work on what you're really good at rather than sort of trying to do too many things at once and therefore sort of weakening either your presence or your quality of work.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, it's a business. You're selling a widget. You know, it's not necessarily a book, and you have to understand how to do that. And if you talk to any major, you know, Fortune 500, you know, CEO, he's not out there doing everything. He's delegating. They're hiring outside companies to do this. They're, you know, nobody does everything in-house. And you, as an author, I think you need to do that too. I write a lot of books with James Patterson. We're on, I think, our sixth book together. And you know, he started in marketing. He actually wrote the Toys R Us theme song a long time ago. You know, I want to be a Toys R Us kid. But when his books first came out, like his very first one was called The Thomas Berryman Number, and I don't think anybody bought that. I'm pretty sure he doesn't even own a copy of that one. His second book was Along Came a Spider, and it sold decent, but it didn't hit it out of the park, you know, not the way he wanted it to. So he did something very different back in the day. He filmed his very own television spot. He'd spent $500 of his own money and filmed a TV spot, and it was really simple. It said something like, your wait for the next Silence of the Lambs is over, and then a tiny little spider just kind of crawled down, and then the title of the book popped up on the screen. It was like a 15-second spot. But that ignited sales. That's what caused that book to really take off. And if he hadn't have done that, we might not know who James Patterson is today. So you have to be willing to, you know, try something different. I call it zigging instead of zagging. You know, even today, like when we've got a new book coming out, like he is hands on with every marketing activity that's happening. I'm constantly learning from that guy.
Mm. I suppose it's one of those moments where you have to pinch yourself as well, JD, when you think about where you've come in this period of time, that you are working alongside somebody like James Patterson, who is probably one of the most well-known authors in the world. Quite easily, everybody knows who James Patterson is. You see his books, even here in the UK, in supermarkets, not just bookshops. There's adverts on television, the adaptations left, right and centre. Obviously, you know, several of his early works have been transformed into films. He is sort of omnipresent in modern thriller writing over the last 20 years, you would say. So for someone, whilst, as you said earlier, you'd done some ghostwriting throughout that before you became a sort of full-time author, it must be remarkable when you think of this kid growing up in Florida and ferrying music stars around in the early 90s to now be co-authoring with probably the most famous thriller writer in the world.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, when I think, like, it's only been 10 years, you know, like it was November of 2014. So, you know, when this all started, so it's been a very short amount of time, but it's been a crazy wild ride. I mean, Stephen King, you know, he read my first book, Forsaken, and let me use some of his characters in here. You know, like I feel like I captured lightning in a bottle with that one. You know, that Bram Stoker's family reached out to me, asked me to write a prequel to Dracula using Bram's original notes. You know, it's like that was another crazy experience. And then, you know, I pick up the phone and here's James Patterson and asking to work together. And, you know, now fast forward a couple of years, we're six books in and we're having a ball.
I mean, often, I think sometimes when people see a book and it's been co-authored, JD, it sometimes could be quite surprising for people how they understand the collaborative process. And I would imagine, because you've worked with Darker Stoker, as you say, on the Dracul prequel and the work you've done with James, but you've also co-written with other authors. Is there a sort of designated best way to do it, or is it a case of you have to find and feel each other out really to see, you know, who wants to mix and who wants to pour? It's that kind of thing, whereas sometimes you can try and do the same thing at the same time and that's obviously not going to work. So is the hardest part working out who does what, or does it just sometimes just seem to flow out naturally once you've got through those initial discussions?
Yeah, well, I had mentioned that, you know, I was working as a book doctor and a ghostwriter. So I did that for 23 years. So I have more years behind my belt working with other people than I actually do writing my own title. So when I sat down to write Forsaken all by myself, that actually felt strange to me, to be in the writing room all on my own. But, you know, I've worked with so many different people. Everybody's got a different style. I find that it's important to figure out what everybody's strengths are at the very beginning, what the weaknesses are, and then, you know, double down on the good stuff and step away from the bad. And it's almost like if you have two people in the kitchen cooking breakfast at the same time, you know, if you both try to make eggs at the same time, it's a problem. But if you have one person making eggs while the other person's making breakfast, everything works out. So we try to feel that kind of thing out at the beginning. I think one of the reasons why it works so well with me and Patterson is because I have tried, you know, I've collaborated with so many different people on so many different levels. I'm wide open to doing it any which way. And he is very much the same. You know, like he can write, you know, 100% of the book. He can write 80% of the book. He can write the outline. You know, so when we work together, we constantly change it up. The first book that we wrote together, he is a notorious outliner. Like he writes 30 to 50,000 words sometimes on just the outline. And I was a pantser. You know, like I came into that world, you know, never using an outline. And when we first met, I didn't think we were going to be able to work together just because we had such different styles. But ultimately he came around and said, you know what, let's try it your way. Let's try pantsing a novel. You know, so I would write a chapter, I would paint him into some kind of crazy impossible scenario, thinking there's no way he's going to get out of this. And then, you know, like 15 minutes later, he'd get the pages, he'd write another chapter. He not only got out of it, but put me into something even worse. And we wrote the whole book that way. It was called The Coast to Coast Murders. It was a lot of fun, but probably the twistiest book I've ever written just because we did that. And then, you know, for the next one, he said, okay, I want you to try it my way. And he sent me an outline for a book called The Noise. And I wrote that one based on an outline. So, you know, we've always changed it up from the get-go. And I think that keeps it fun and keeps it fresh for us as the writers and the readers, you know, pick up on that too.
Mm. Well, I suppose that's something that's quite striking, I suspect, because everything I've heard you say in the past and everything I've read of yours, that there is this sort of overriding arc of pushing the boundaries and keeping your readers on your toes, as we said earlier on about how you've jumped from genres, you've mixed it up, you've co-written in different ways with other people. You always seem to embrace the challenge, JD, in regards to pushing yourself both as a person and an author in regards to some of the ways that you've changed. And often, as we were saying, some people can kind of get stuck in a rut, but you love to kind of push yourself out of that comfort zone, it would seem, over your career.
Well, I think those ruts happen when you keep doing the same thing over and over again and you get bored with it. And, you know, if you're writing and you're bored with the writing process because you haven't changed it up, you know, the reader's going to pick up on that. They're very good at finding those cues between the lines. So I'm always trying new things. You can't see it on screen here, but I've got a typewriter behind me. So every day I come in, I write a sentence or two on a book that I'm writing on that typewriter. I've got another one I'm working on where I'm writing it out longhand. I find that if I use different mediums, my voice is different and I end up telling a very different story. So I've got a podcast of my own called Writers Inc. where we interview all the biggest names out there. We get their origin story. And I love to hear the writing process. And every time I hear something new that I haven't tried yet, you know, I add it to my list of things to do.
Well, I think as with anything, it's horses for courses. A lot of people really sort of struggle to kind of take the plunge, really, JD, and because, you know, it's one of those cliches that everyone has a book in them, whether we want to read it or not. And I think often, do you think it's become easier in the modern age because of the rise of self-publishing? Or do you think it's become harder for somebody who has got something worthy to share because the volume has increased so dramatically over the last sort of 10 years?
Yeah, I mean, I think when Forsaken came out, it was less than a million books were published that year. This past year, I think it was 2.4 million. Now with the rise of AI, there's no telling what that number is going to be. But your book is, you know, basically one, you know, of that number. So you have to figure out what you're going to do to stand out. I think every book that gets published needs to be a 5-star read. Like, I don't think it should be published without that. One of the biggest mistakes I see people make, particularly on the self-publishing front, you know, they'll write a book, they'll send it off to agents, they get rejection after rejection after rejection. Finally, they just throw their hands up in the air and they say, I'm just going to self-publish it. And like, that is the wrong reason to self-publish. What you really need to do is find out why all these people rejected you. Figure out what's wrong with the book, because there is something wrong with the book if everybody is telling you no, and fix that problem and then put it out. Like, you should never self-publish a book unless it's something that Random House would also want to put out. Like, it should be an either or decision, not a, you know, one or the other kind of decision. Because what I see happening is they write their book, they throw it up on Amazon, they hit that publish button, you know, their friends and family find it, they get, you know, 5, 10, 15, 5-star reviews from people that know them. And then all of a sudden, the real readers find that book and they start to tear it apart. You know, it's got typos, it's got, you know, continuity problems, it's got dialogue issues or whatever it is. But all of a sudden, it's got a 2.5-star rating. And, you know, that's your legacy as an author. So when you write that next book, you know, whether you send it off to agents or, you know, you just put it back up on Amazon, that's the track record people are going to see for you. And, you know, you could be dead in the water with that second, third, fourth, fifth book, you know, if you don't get the first one right. So I encourage people to, you know, take the time. You know, I think everybody needs to write at least 500,000 words before they actually figure out what they're doing, before you find your own voice. It's like anything else. I mean, if you're going to be a surgeon, they don't just throw you into the operating room. There's a couple of years of school you have to go to. You need to learn your craft. And this is no different.
I suppose as well, like you say, it's often easier to ignore the reasons why something's declined or there isn't that interest, as you say. Whereas really, I mean, it's excellent advice, even though a lot of people don't take it on board, JD. It's almost as if they become too precious about it. And I think sometimes if you're wanting to proceed in any field, regardless of what you have a passion for, you've got to learn what you're not doing right or better ways to do things before you even push yourself forward, because if you do, you're setting yourself up for a fail sooner rather than later.
Yeah, and as unfortunate as it is, I don't think you can teach somebody how to write. Like, you can teach them the grammatical rules, you know, a comma needs to go here, this needs to happen. You know, people can learn that, but there's also something else. I call it the storyteller gene. You know, some people have it and some people don't. If you've got a group of people around a campfire and one person can tell a story and completely captivate that audience, that person has it, but not everybody does. And, you know, unfortunately, I see a lot of books where somebody tries to write a book and they just don't have that particular skill within them. And I don't think you could teach somebody how to properly tell a story. That's, I think, ingrained within an individual. You can learn every other aspect of this, but not how to tell a story. And sometimes that's a hard truth for people to get. You know, I've met some people that absolutely want to become writers. They work at it day in and day out, but they can't get that one little piece, and they probably never will.
I think sometimes it's one of those things. I think people say, well, you're just writing words. How hard can it be? But like you say, it's got to be compelling on whatever reason. It has to find an audience. And you can tell a story, like you say, but if there's nothing that pulls you in or keeps your attention on any level, whether you're speaking to people or you're networking or you're writing or whatever, then it's always going to fall flat. There's got to be a spark there. There's got to be something that pulls even one person in before you can even do that. And often people, I think, because it's that they just see it as words on a page, whereas you've got to be able to create the ingredients that make people want to go on. Anybody can write words, but it's whether they make sense and take you on a journey, whatever field you want to write in.
Well, I think, you know, in a lot of ways, school does us a disservice when it comes to that, because, you know, we go through all of our, you know, early grade school, high school, all the way through college. You know, we're writing papers, we're writing this, we're writing that. But that's not the same thing as writing a book. You know, like when I write a book, like I create my characters to the point where they become very real people to me. I can hear their voices. I can see what they're doing, their mannerisms, everything about them is 100% real. And when I sit down to write that book, I'm literally watching a movie in my head and I'm documenting what I see these people do. You know, their vocal style, you know, their vocabulary, their cadence may be completely different from one character to the next, just like they would be in real life. And like that needs to happen. And like, that's not something I think you can teach. You know, you can tweak it in somebody that might have, you know, 80% of it, you might be able to get them to 90 or 100, but they have to have something there to begin with.
I suppose it's one of the key facets of what I enjoy about your writing is that often I will read one of your books, JD, and I will suddenly find myself I'm 70 pages in and I can't stop. And I both love and hate that about an author, because sometimes you've got things to do, but reading sometimes just takes you away and almost becomes addictive. You have to keep it on. And I've had it in the past where I've bought a book and I've read it within 3 days and I've stayed up far too late into the wee small hours reading. But I think when something gets under your skin as much as that, it's a really powerful thing. And therefore, for you, when you're looking at crafting your stories, as a writer, do you sometimes get the sort of opposite effect that you can't stop writing a particular chapter or a particular scene because it's almost pulling you along with it at sometimes?
Yeah, I mean, that sometimes happens, and the opposite happens where you have to force it out. It's like getting water out of a stone. Mm. But, you know, like the writing process itself is very slow. You know, like you can read that book far faster than I can ever write it. So a scene to me that may take 2 or 3 days to write, maybe something that somebody's going to read, you know, in 5 or 10 minutes. You know, so it's like I basically have to take a step back. You know, so after I get a book done, I usually put it in a drawer for a little bit and then I come back and revisit it, you know, so I can read it as a reader would. And that's where I really learn like what works and what doesn't work. But I also rely very heavily on beta readers. I give beta readers, I've got 6 different ones. I give them printed copies of the books. I tell them to highlight anything that they, you know, where they feel like they're skimming, you know, like I want to know where they're bored. So I have them highlight those sections. I ask them to tell me anytime they close the book, you know, so I don't care if they have to go pick up their kids from school or it's time to make dinner or they have to go to work. I want to know where they think it's okay to close that cover of the book. And I make them mark those pages. And when I get all those beta reader copies back, I look at all that stuff. And if I see multiple people, you know, highlighting the same sections, closing the book in the same place, I rewrite that to try and, you know, keep that from happening. Ultimately, I'm shooting for what I call literary popcorn. You know, like just one more piece. You can't stop flipping those pages, just like you said. You know, that's my goal.
Well, I think it's always, it's important as well, isn't it? That, like you say, you kind of, this far into your career, you kind of know yourself far better than you ever thought you probably could in regards to how you write now. Like you say, I mean, I'm fascinated to hear that you use different mediums, because often people would presume that you write everything on a laptop, perhaps, JD. Whereas I've spoken to authors before who only do it long form, or some will only use a typewriter. Whereas, do you think that sometimes depends on the kind of book that you're trying to craft? Or, as you were saying there, where you kind of try, it's almost like trying to get water out of a stone. Does sometimes changing the medium that you're writing on make it easier to break through that kind of sort of, bubble that you've cocooned yourself in sometimes?
Yeah, I think it depends a lot on the book. Like the book that I'm writing on the typewriter, it's a detective noir, you know, kind of book. You know, like it, to me, that just felt right coming off of a typewriter. If I write something, you know, in longhand on a notepad, it's usually in first person, because to me, writing, you know, is very personal when you're actually writing it out with pen and paper. You know, so I think all of those things can play into it. And back when I used to mentor authors, I would sometimes make them do that. You know, like if somebody, you know, like I would recognize that spark. I could tell that they actually knew how to write, but they weren't quite sure how to get what they had in their head onto the paper. I would have them try different things. So sometimes I would have them write it on a notepad just so they and force them to write it in first person instead of third, because it comes across as more believable. You know, if you're writing I, you're describing what's going on in your own head. You can later tweak that and turn it into a character, but it comes across a lot more believable than if you're writing in third person. Sometimes just changing the tense, writing in present tense instead of past tense, you know, can make a world of difference.
I suppose with the new book, as we've touched on before in regards to The Shining, really, as being what some people would consider to be a haunted house book. But as you say, I think it's a book with numerous levels that, depending on what scares you the most, you can look at that as one man's descent into madness, a frustration of life rearing its head into domestic violence, or the house is possessed and it's taken over Jack. There are numerous ways of looking at it, and also you can see that in the varying versions that have been adapted for the screen as well, that they all seem to have a very different flavour to King's original work. With the latest book, Something I Keep Upstairs, this is a classic haunted house book, but obviously with a bit of a twist, as we would expect from yourself, but also with an incredible marketing strategy behind it as well. So was it a haunted house book something you always wanted to do? Because as you were talking about creating your worlds and your storyline, this is something that's based in reality. You've got sort of first-person experience of this particular property that is the centerpiece for this marvelous and rather creepy story you're unleashing upon us.
Yeah, I always wanted to write a haunted house book, but I knew that if I did it, I couldn't do, you know, the same model that everybody else does. You know, like, you know, family moves into a house, you know, this is going on, they learn this, and then all of a sudden they try to resolve it. That story has been done to death. I knew I didn't want to do that. So I twisted the model on its head. So in Something I Keep Upstairs, a kid, he's 17 years old, his grandmother passes away, and she leaves him her house. And it's a very unique house. It's on a private island right off the coast of a little town called Newcastle, New Hampshire. It's the only house on the island. The island's only about an acre, but she leaves him this entire property. He's 17 years old, so he does exactly what you would expect a 17-year-old boy to do with a house like that. He turns it into a party house for him and his friends. You know, someplace they can all go, you know, away from the parents, away from the police, and just have some fun. But, you know, partying gets old after a while, and at some point, one of those kids raises their hand and says, hey, what would it take to turn this into a haunted house? Because it's a perfectly normal house. So they start exactly where you would expect. They tell a couple of scary stories. Somebody brings a Ouija board in. But, you know, they escalate. And the tagline for the book is, for a haunted house to be born, somebody has to die. So you know where they're going. But a book like this is all about the journey. So to me, like that was the twist. That had never been done before. We've all seen the haunted house story over and over again. We've never seen somebody try to take a perfectly normal house and turn it into a haunted house. So that was part of it. But like the other half is, you know, I mentioned the story takes place in Newcastle, New Hampshire. I actually live in Newcastle, New Hampshire. It's a small island off the coast of Portsmouth in New England here in the States. The house is a real house. It actually exists. I go on a run every day. When we finish up today, I'm going to leave the house and I'm going to do a lap around the island where I live. And at some point, I'm going to be standing out on the beach. And if I look out over the water, I'm going to see Wood Island, where this particular house is. It's about a quarter mile off our shore. I did that run every day for about 2 years and just stared out at that house trying to figure out what was going on out there. You know, like the what if gene within my head kept going off. Yeah. And that's really where the story itself was born. I got to know the people who actually owned it. Turns out it used to be a Coast Guard life-saving station, and a guy had taken it upon himself to raise money and try to restore it. So I got to go out to the house, to the island, and I have over the years. Now it's finally finished and the book is done. So we've decided to tie all of it together. So they're actually decorating the interior of the house to match what I had in my book, which is kind of full circle. Right. So when you walk into that house, it's going to match what I have in the story. But to promote the book, you know, we had talked about marketing. You know, I stepped back and looked at it, you know, like, what is everybody else doing? I needed something different. We're going to give away an overnight stay in this haunted house on a private island. So 1 month after publication, we're going to draw one lucky name out of a hat. They're going to get to pick three of their friends, and we're going to take them by boat out to this private island, drop them off on the dock, and leave them in a haunted house for 24 hours. Nobody's coming back for them for 24 hours. So we'll see what happens. But, you know, like from a marketing standpoint, you know, like I can buy Facebook ads, I can buy Amazon ads, I can buy TV spots, I can do all those things. But the one thing that actually sells books is word of mouth. And when people find out that they've got the opportunity to stay in a haunted house that a book is based on, you know, a real haunted house, they are talking about it. You know, I'll do it if you do it. Will you do it? I'll do it if you go, you know, but like they are chatting it up all over the place. And that's what you want, you know, from a marketing.
Absolutely. And I think it's wonderful, really, because obviously the story of this house is that, you know, it was essentially about to fall down before this chap decided to try and restore it. And as you say, he's turning it into a museum later this year. It's going to become a focal point for the locality. You visited it. How did you find it? Did you visit it prior to the renovation, or have you kind of made sort of regular journeys to it, JD, as the transformation has gone on? Or was it a case of you've gone when it's almost finished and you've been able to sort of build this relationship with the new owners going forwards?
No, the first time I was out there was several years ago. It was before I knew anything about the history of the house or the island. I was trying to research the area, and I went out there with the guy who was restoring it. And they were maybe a quarter of the way through the renovation at that point. And like when I set foot on that island, like something felt off to me. I don't necessarily believe in ghosts, but I'm smart enough to understand that there's a lot I don't understand. And when I went in that house, like all I wanted to do was get out. Like every instinct in my body was saying, you don't want to be in here, get out of this house. And, you know, I try to explain that. And I think in a lot of ways, you know, people have, you know, we have these instincts, but I think we've trained them out of ourselves over, you know, the generations, over the millennia. You know, like if you're in a room with a cat and there's a loud noise in the corner of the room, that cat is going to bolt. It's gone. It doesn't care what made the noise. It doesn't want to know. It's protecting its own butt. It disappears. But a person will walk over to the corner of the room, wherever that noise originated, and start sniffing around and try to figure out what actually made that sound. Which is stupid. You know, like the correct response is to run away. That fight or flight, you know, kind of gene should kick in. But like I stood in that house, I didn't know anything about it. But like I had that weird feeling, hair on the back of my neck is standing up. I wanted to leave. So like after that, I went home and just started to research it. And when I started to realize what had actually taken place on that island over the hundreds and hundreds of years before I stood there, I knew that was the basis of the story. There's a lot more to it, and that history plays a big part of it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this is the thing. There are some very strange things that are attached to this particular location that you've been able to uncover as part of your research in regards to this and the history of the island and the house as well, JD. I've heard you speak about a couple of these things. They are odd, to say the very least. And we're not talking about anything outlandish or out of this world. You know, we're not talking about people claiming that there's a portal to hell or anything. We're talking about strange events based in reality that, when you started looking into them, they just seem to open up even more questions. And I would imagine when you looked at that, you probably couldn't believe your luck, because it's great crafting a wonderfully thrilling, frightening story about a real location. But then when you've got weird things happening around this area that make no sense, I suppose that even takes it to a different level, even for somebody with your writing experience and love of history.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, because when you stand out on the beach and you look out at this house, it looks like a postcard. It's very picturesque. It's a beautiful little house, you know, sun setting behind it, lighthouse off to the side. What you don't see, like in the water, is filled with great whites. You know, like that particular water, there's an inlet there. You know, the water's a little warmer, so the fish come in, the seals come in, and the sharks come in after them. You know, so you don't see any of that. That's all happening below the surface. Yeah. And then the house itself, at one point, it was a quarantine facility for yellow fever. They just put people out there that had yellow fever and you know, more or less left them out there. During the Spanish-American War, if they captured a vessel, they would make a dock out there and they would literally just wait them out. You know, they didn't provide food. They would wait for the people on that ship to die away from starvation or disease. And then they would take the boat, you know, because that's what they ultimately wanted. And the bodies went overboard into the water, you know, to feed those sharks. We've had a lot of paranormal investigators that have come out and looked at this place. And the one theory that seems to come up consistently is that all life is based on energy. You know, so with something passes away, whether it's good, bad, or, you know, whatever, that energy has to go somewhere. So when a lot of that happens in one particular spot, it's almost like a battery, you know, like all of that energy is sort of, you know, trapped in one place. So we found tons of things throughout history. You know, I went back maybe 500-600 years and just found all these different events very similar to this. In 1972, two bodies were found on the beach. Somebody was out there picnicking and they found skeletons buried in the sand. And it became this jurisdictional like hot potato because the island itself is right on the border of Maine and New Hampshire. So nobody knew who was supposed to actually take charge of this investigation. And ultimately the FBI came in and took it over. I found one newspaper article about all of this. And then the story just vanished. I contacted all the local law enforcement offices and nobody had a record of it. Contacted the FBI. They couldn't find a file on it. So two bodies basically disappeared. And we know it happened because there's photos, you know, like in the original newspaper article. I even reached out to some of the people that were in those photographs and spoke to them. But to this day, they don't know, you know, what happened to those bodies. They don't know who they were. And the cool thing is with this book coming out, you know, we've had a chance to talk about this. The FBI is reopening the case. They're looking at it, trying to find, you know, figure out what happened and take it from there. You know, so sooner or later we'll get some resolution. But like we found story after story after story all around this tiny little island.
I mean, it's one of those things, I suppose, as well. When you've worked in this and you've obviously covered stories of serial killers and detectives dealing with some very strange cases, this just is a cold case goldmine, really, JD, like you say, because, yes, it's terrible you find two bodies on a beach, but the fact that this investigation seems to just disappear and nobody seems to know who did what and why it stopped or whatever, to now here we are, what, 53 years later, they're going back to it, because there are so many cases that perhaps have been lost to time that people never thought would be concluded, that thanks to forensic evidence and sort of the on-moving work in regards to DNA especially, cases that would have seemed unsolvable 30, 40, 50 years ago are being solved in the modern era. And I think that is a remarkable thing, really, that here you are creating this wonderful new story about this and you uncover a lost cold case that really needs resolving.
Yeah, I mean, I'm hoping they're able to find it. I think you're right. I think DNA is probably going to solve, you know, something this old. They've got no other clue. You know, there's literally nothing else. But before they can even do that, they've got to find the bodies. They need to figure out what happened to them after they removed them from that island, because nobody seems to know. It's crazy to think that kind of thing even happens, you know, but it, you know, it does. And I think it happens a lot more often than we realize.
Oh, definitely. It's not an outlier, that kind of case, is it? I mean, it happens so many times that things go away or people disappear and then a body turns up or whatever. Or say, yeah, we're dealing with this. And then the evidence just disappears and people find them in a box 20 years later.
Yeah. So we'll see what happens. I mean, this is putting a big spotlight on it, which is fantastic. Hopefully we'll be able to figure it out and maybe get some closure for a family out there that might, you know, still have some unanswered questions. You never know.
Mm-hmm. Well, listen, before I let you leave, and thank you so much for your time, it's been a real pleasure to finally speak with you after reading your work over the best part of the last 10 years and being thrilled and terrified in equal measure throughout. What's next for you, JD? Obviously, as I say, we've got this incredible competition with the new book that's out in the next few days, something I keep upstairs. So for you, with the stories and the worlds that you've already created, I know you're looking in sort of adding to those sort of histories that you've got built up. What goes next for you, sir?
I kind of stumbled into another fun project. So one of my favorite movies from the 90s was called Flatliners. I don't know if you remember, with Kiefer Sutherland, Julia Roberts, Billy Baldwin, Oliver Platt. It had this crazy cast all at the beginning of their career, so nobody really knew who they were. Yeah. I have loved that movie my entire life. And it turns out the guy who wrote it was on one of my other projects. He was working on Dracul. So at one point we got to talking and I told him, listen, I've got an idea idea to reboot this franchise if you ever want to do it. And he got the rights back about, I guess, about a year and a half ago and reached out to me. So we are literally finishing up that book now. We're writing a novel to reboot the Flatliners franchise. And we're doing it totally backwards. It's coming out as a book first and then a feature film or a series later. Mm. Hopefully we're going to be able to revitalize that. But it's one of my favorite stories and we're bringing it into the modern era.
Fabulous. I watched that. I mean, we're a very similar vintage, you and I, JD. I've watched that film far more than most people. And it's just one of those iconic teenage films that you get into at that particular era. That it was just a fascinating kind of trip into near-death experiences and the potential of what could be there. And, the original's, 35 years old? I think it's 1990 Flatliners came out.
Yeah, 1990.
And, I still remember the twist at the end and the incredible cast that they had. Obviously, for a lot of people, Flatliners was probably the Brat Pack supernatural film you watch after Lost Boys, I think. It's of that kind of ilk. So it's clearly a film that's been loved. And I know there was a remake about 10 years ago, I think, which kind of fell flat because it's one of those films that, when it came out, it was so standalone in its own little world that I think it really bit people like ourselves because it was very different, but it had the actors and that we were all aware of and we felt we were growing up at the same period because of all the films that they were making in that late early 90s period.
Yeah, I mean, it's for people who haven't seen it, it's about medical students who decide to kill each other one at a time to discover whether there's life after death. So they literally kill each other and bring each other back trying to solve that question. I think that's why the story itself holds up. I think the remake didn't work. I think it was 2016 where they did it, mainly because they just rehashed the original story. They more or less told the original story with new actors, but they didn't change anything. So what we've actually done, I can't give away the twist, but we've come up with a way to take it into the current environment. And it's a very fresh take on it. It's very different from what they've done in the past.
Mouth-watering there. I can't wait to get my teeth into that. Well, JD, once again, thank you so much. Where can everybody follow you online, follow your work, get a hold of the new book and see your previous works and just sign up for your mailing list and anything else you'd like to mention, sir?
Easiest place to find me is jdbarker.com. I'm on all the social medias at jdbarker. Latest book is Something I Keep Upstairs. It releases May 13th.
Brilliant. Well, I'll put links to everything in the show notes, including this wonderful competition for everybody to join in and hopefully win that wonderful prize. I think for anybody who listens to this show, there's not much better that they could have other than a weekend away with Bigfoot, probably. JD. So listen, thank you again for your time. I wish you all the very best, and I hope to speak to you again in the future.
Thanks for having me on the show. I appreciate it. Take care.